I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City Councilman Scott Taylor is running for mayor, and at the moment, it looks like he's doing a lot right. But will his 8 years of experience on the council be enough to get him into the runoff come April? Today, we'll talk with Taylor about KC's affordable housing crunch, a violent crime problem, and what direction he'd like to take the city. Then, 19 years after being eliminated in the U.S., a measles outbreak in Washington State has sprung up. We'll talk with a medical professional about whether the skepticism of vaccinations is growing, and we'll learn why getting your kids vaccinated helps those who can't. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Councilman Scott Taylor has a plan for Kansas City's East Side, and he may have the most visible on-the-ground campaign for mayor as well. Taylor has been canvassing neighborhoods for weeks with a team of campaign workers. He's also sponsored Saturday morning coffee clutches to discuss city issues. But where does he want to take the city, and where does he stand on the big issues? We're about to find out. We're joined now by Councilman Scott Taylor, who is the 6th District at-large representative from the city's South Side. Councilman, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Great to be back, Steve. Thank you.
The two obvious way to begin these conversations with our mayoral candidates is the most basic one of all. Why do you want the job, Scott?
Well, Steve, I think it's important that we continue the momentum we built over the last 8 years. It's been a real privilege to serve on the city council during the renaissance of Kansas City. As you remember, 8 years ago, this city was shut down. We had just come out of the Great Recession. We had a mayoral administration with a newcomer, Funkhauser, who made many mistakes. And it was important that we reopen the city for business to create opportunities for all in the city. And I want to continue that work.
You know, the city would look different as a result of a Mayor Scott Taylor administration. How?
Well, we would move forward and continue to build on what we've built the last 8 years. And so I have, I think you can see from my style as chairing the Planning, Zoning, Economic Development Committee, where just about every week we have controversial issues that impact neighborhoods come in. We have done it in a collaborative, respectful manner. So I would carry that on as mayor. And any issue that we tackle, we bring people together, take our time like we did on the East Side Plan, provide a lot of opportunities for public input, and shape policy based on that.
You know, what do you wish Mayor James had done, Scott, that he didn't do?
Mayor James has done a lot of great things, and his leadership's been invaluable. And so, while we've had our disagreements on things like the airport selection process and some other areas, when they attempted to privatize ambulance billing workers, we stood up for that, or privatize the workers at the airport. Generally, I think we've gotten most of the things done that we set out to do, big ticket items, including getting the airport moving forward. The streetcar expansion was one thing that is moving forward again. That did not happen the first time around.
Yeah.
So that's one thing.
How confident are you that we're going to see expansion of the streetcar during this next calendar year here?
I think it's more likely that we'll see the riverfront expansion because it's a smaller segment, and that can be privately financed through Port KC and being involved. And I sit on the advisory committee for the port. And I'm really excited about all the potential projects. I think the riverfront will be built out in the next 5 to 10 years, and we could include some affordable housing or workforce housing on the riverfront.
So. You've mentioned the airport a couple of times. How was the whole KCI terminal, single terminal plan handled in your view? What do you hear from your constituents? What did you think of the whole process?
Well, when I've walked door to door now since last January 2nd of 2018, I went out myself, and there were days where it was 19 degrees. It was actually a nicer winter last winter than it was this winter. But there's still a lot of skepticism as to what happened with the process. I called it during the selection process a sloppy process. It really, starting out with a lunch in a private club was probably not the best way to start the process, and a no bid process. So We've opened it up, had a bidding process. It's moving forward. It's been a version of our Kansas City reality TV show in a way, but we've got to keep moving it forward regardless of what's happened in the past.
Well, what did you say at the time? Why didn't you speak out more forcefully about the no-bid contract that was being contemplated for Burns and Mack early on?
Well, we did, and that's why and a lot of the other council members agreed. That's why we opened it up to a bid process. And so, you know, it was through that discussion that moved it into a process. You know, while I disagreed with the selection, I still think the hometown team would have been a better selection initially. We're past that. You know, I think they had addressed a lot of the labor issues and MBEWB issues up front, which would have we may be under construction had they started moving forward on it. But we are where we're at, and the next mayor really needs to be vigilant and hands-on and make sure this moves forward as smoothly as possible.
Well, what were city leaders thinking at the time as they approached the idea of building this billion-dollar project without issuing any bids?
Well, you'll have to ask the ones that were pushing for that. And I'm not included in that category, so that's really a question for them. But like I said, we need to move forward. I'm being positive and try not to be too blunt in my comments or criticisms. But I'll contrast that, if I have a second, to just talk about a process I was involved in and led, which was the revitalization of the Kemper Arena. We had a structure that the city owned, costing us $1 million a year. We did a national bid process, as transparent as could be. We had hearings down inside Kemper Arena for the public to make it easy. We ended up selecting the local developer in that case, and they've brought in $39 million from outside of Kansas City, private sector dollars. It's open on time and doing great things for the community.
Councilman Scott Taylor is my guest. He's a candidate for the mayorship of Kansas City. How would your style of leadership differ from Mayor James, Scott? How would things be different?
Well, I think we're moving into a time where you have to be more collaborative. And to the mayor's credit, he got things done early on. Had a supportive council. The first 4 years, as we were coming out of the recession, we had to move forward quickly on things. So his leadership style worked perfectly for the time period. But we're now in a time in Kansas City where you really do need to take time and collaborate upfront in the process with neighborhoods, with community leaders to make better policy.
Has he pushed ahead in this second term too quickly, too fast at times, in your view?
You know, I'll leave that up to the citizens to decide. I think he's I'm not going to criticize him necessarily for moving forward on initiatives he thinks. Yeah. Now, I just think times have changed even the last couple of years in the city, and we need to collaborate more.
It sounds like you're saying that your style of leadership would more closely resemble Kay Barnes than perhaps Sly James. Am I hearing that right, or am I reaching too far?
I would collaborate the Taylor style, and that's what we've done the last 8 years in planning and zoning and other initiatives. I'll give you another great example. Regionally, we need to collaborate more, and the mayor's done a good job of reaching out to our neighbors on different issues. But I led the effort on Tobacco 21 from the council perspective, working with the chamber to increase the sale of the age from 18 to 21, because we know statistically that will reduce teen smoking. 22 other municipalities have followed our lead, and we've helped along the way to provide information and guidance. And so Kansas City needs to continue that regional leadership like we've done so well in the past.
How about a really tough issue, Scott? What is Kansas City doing that's not working when it comes to reducing violent crime in this town? How do you reduce violent crime?
Well, it's one of the most important issues, obviously, we face. It impacts a lot of families, impacts all of us in some manner. We have had more successful years. We've had the lowest rate of homicides back in 2014 after we implemented KC Nova. But we need to continue implementing other things. And we also need to work with our police force to make sure they have the proper staffing funding so that they can do community policing and build these relationships. We can, you know, we always talk about community policing, but if you don't provide the resources, it's really hard to make it happen.
So we need more officers in the KCPD?
I've advocated for that in the last budget. We actually increased the number of officers. You know, the police chief was asking for 30 additional. We got close to it. I think we got to 23 versus where we started with the budget, mm-hmm. only through advocating through the budget process. We're going to have that same discussion this year. And I realize it's the argument on the other side from some on the Finance Committee is that it's a budget issue and we're using a lot of our money for public safety, high percentage. Well, we should be.
76%, I think, is the last number I saw. That's a big chunk of the general fund.
It is, but it's also our number one responsibility as a city to provide a safe city for our citizens. Mm-hmm. So it's an investment is the way I look at it. And I want to applaud our KCPD. I've worked with them on a lot of these new initiatives, such as at the South Patrol Station. We built a campus-like setting so we could have public events. In the last year or so, we've had we started movie nights out on summer nights. We bring out families from the community. Had about 500 kids at the last one, which was Coco, the animated series, had set up a film and free popcorn and hot dogs. Small businesses get involved, donate it. I think one of the local merchants donated 25 bikes to be raffled off mm-hmm. to kids. It builds that cohesiveness at an early age. That's going to take longer to see the results, but examples like that, an ex-offender affair, the South Patrol's been sponsoring. I was a co-sponsor of. Bring in 25 small businesses that are ready to hire and are open to hiring ex-offenders so that they can go back to work, be productive in society again. We need to do a lot more of that collaboratively with the police department.
You mentioned the need for other initiatives. What do you have in mind to help reduce violent crime?
So right now, police chief is looking at a lot of different programs, but there's one specifically in Tampa that is has some similarities to KC Nova, but I think is something they've gotten really good results there and some other initiatives.
How's it different than KC Nova?
Well, that's what we need to get into as far as the specifics on it. But, you know, KC Nova, basically, you target the highest percentage of offenders with the idea that not only do you target them to go after them, to let them know they're being watched and create some accountability, there are social services involved. We need to match our social services. One of the things we've done in this last budget, which we need to continue, is we've placed within each of the police stations a social worker.
Right.
And it's really to match existing services. So it doesn't cost a lot to keep that person out. Meeting with those that are at risk in the community to either commit a crime or to be victims to provide the services, whether it's domestic violence, mental health, because we have a lot of great organizations ready to step up if they can be matched with these people.
You know, just my own observation, you get a sense that the city has sort of reached a little bit of an impasse right now when it comes to dealing with violent crime. It seems like we've tried a lot of the new age ideas to move forward on this mm-hmm. issue, and I haven't seen new initiatives lately. I don't know, in fairness to everybody, if there are new things to try. And I just sort of wind up wondering, Scott, what is it about Kansas City, and St. Louis for that matter, that our cities in Missouri always rank so highly on these most violent cities in America lists? You know, other big cities in the region don't. What's going on here? Do we know?
I think there are a couple things. There are a lot of large cities facing the same issues. We're not alone. You may be able to pick a few examples where it's different, but a lot of cities are in the same position. In Missouri, we obviously have the same state law with respect to guns, and mm-hmm. That's been an issue, and we've voiced our concern. We're preempted on just about everything we talk about.
You're with the mayor when it comes to cracking down on gun possession, if you could wave your magic wand.
And we've tried, you know, we had legislation out there that was good for about, 12 days before the legislature stepped in and preempted it. I led the effort to encourage Congress after the Las Vegas shootings to ban bump stocks. That seemed like a simple idea. Nothing happened, obviously, with Congress, but the executive branch, I think, is finally doing something about that. Mm-hmm. But that seems like a no-brainer. There's only one purpose for those bump stocks, and that's to kill a lot of people quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, reasonable background check, you know, things like that would go a long way. But
it's frustrating. We just don't seem to be able to move forward on this issue. It's been consistently over 100 homicides for any number of years now. There was that dip in 2014, I think,
right.
But we remain stuck, you know?
So it's an ongoing challenge. We need to continue, though, building that relationship. And that's where I think between the police department and especially at a younger age, children to have a positive experience with the police department.
That's still an issue, particularly on the east side, you think?
Well, it's all over. We need mm-hmm. to build that trust, and all the police stations could be doing the same thing we're doing out at South Patrol, because I think it's really having a positive impact. The other area we haven't talked about that we've changed just recently, we're seeing positive impact on, is TIPS hotline. So mm-hmm. the TIPS hotline for decades was at about $1,000. Not much in today's dollars to really get people to take a chance and provide a tip. To the police chief's credit, Chief Smith came in and suggested we need to increase that because, you know, there's cities like Omaha that offer quite a bit more money. Mm-hmm. And as a result, their clearance rate on homicides was near 90%. So 90% wow. are solved. Ours was at about 50% last year and for the last couple of years. So you had a 50-50 chance of getting away with a homicide if you did it. And I think people know that there's that chance mm-hmm. in some of these cases. So one of the things that was getting frustrating, especially when you have children that are murdered, we want to get those perpetrators off the street. And some of us on the council stepped up and put our own money in. Alexis Kane, for example, was murdered out in southeast Kansas City. And we put in $1,000 just to increase the award amount. Mm-hmm. In that case, I think three individuals were captured, prosecuted, taken off the street. But we should have a higher amount. So it's been increased from 5 up to 10. I think the corporate community could really play a role in being part of this fund and adding even more money to make it 20,000, because we're getting a lot more tips. It's creating accountability.
Councilman Scott Taylor is my guest. He's running for Kansas City mayor. You know, Scott, what's your plan for improving the stock of affordable housing in this town? That's emerged as an issue in this campaign. What's the Scott Taylor plan?
So affordable housing is an issue all across the country. And we're fortunate in Kansas City because we're talking about a lot earlier than cities like Seattle did before Amazon came in. And we kind of have seen what happens in other cities if you don't take action. So give credit to the Housing Committee. We've had the Housing Committee for 4 years. They're taking action finally on some ordinances at the end of the fourth year. But that's good. There's some good policies in there. From the Planning and Zoning Committee, I can tell you we see the economics of a lot of these projects. So market rate, obviously, the reason why we've had so many market rate apartments is when you can charge higher rents, it's more feasible on paper to get a bank loan to build it. Mm-hmm. If you want to mandate lower rents for affordable housing for new construction, there's always going to be a gap. So we've traditionally relied on the low-income tax credits of the state, which are uncertain depending on who the governor is. We found that out pretty quickly.
Right.
Or HUD. And HUD's on, you know, with the federal government, we've learned in the last couple of years you can't really predict what's going to happen any day until you look at Twitter in the morning. Mm-hmm. So we need a local fund, and I think we're all in agreement on. And now the question is, how do we fund that? I don't necessarily
the $75 million trust fund that you're mentioning.
That's what they're proposing, and we've got an East Side Plan, a $10 million home repair fund, which does the same thing. If you can fix up some of these affordable homes that are in the community already, that probably is a less expensive way to create affordable housing.
I mean, do you favor requiring every developer who gets a tax break on a new project to provide for affordable housing in some way, you know, whether it's through setting aside units in that complex or paying into an affordable housing fund of some kind?
I'll tell you, I sit on this committee where we've seen these projects come forward, and we have a lot of developers now that understand it's important to have that as part of their project voluntarily. So I'll give you a great example.
Would you require it?
Well, I'll get to that in just a second. But we have City Club, for example, down at, I think, 20th and Main. It's going to be transformative. They have, I think, 20% affordable. And their whole philosophy as the developer is you want all segments of income in a building because it creates more vitality for the community.
That's interesting.
And we need more developers like that. And they're hopefully we'll do more of that work in Kansas City. That was voluntary. I could name several other projects. As far as mandating it, I think if the percentage is reasonable, we're not going to get there mandating even 10 or 15%. The number of units would be so small, it's not going to get to the point. I think we need to look kind of bigger picture. The thing we have to be careful of from a development standpoint, though, is not to mandate ourselves where there is no construction, because then we won't have affordable. We will have no development, and so we got to balance that. And that percentage is really where you have to be careful, I think, as far as what you mandate.
So that remains an issue in terms of how you want to approach it going forward. That would be an issue for you coming out of the gate as mayor?
Yeah, I think it's an important issue, and I think the key is to find a way to finance that local fund, okay? Mm-hmm. Because if you have that local fund that can close the gap, I guarantee you'll have more developers. We have some great smaller developers that are doing smaller projects, I mean, like in the Northeast, Brinshore. Name you may not have heard about, but they've got three very wonderful projects that are going to be great for the community, affordable housing. But they require, you know, HUD to be involved. And so if we have our own local fund, we can encourage two or three, four or five times as much as what's happening now. We do have some affordable housing being built each year. It's just not enough.
Yeah.
Not quick enough.
How about the mayor's early childhood education plan that'll be on the ballot in April when your field of mayoral candidates is on the ballot as well? Do you favor that idea?
Yeah, I'll tell you about my stance on it. So I'm, I think, the only candidate that's on the school board. I've been on the center school board. I was on it for 4 years during the turnaround of that school district. So we increased teachers' pay, increased test scores as a result in just a few years. Now the school district, at one point 10 years ago, we were looking at closing a neighborhood school. We're now, they're expanding in all four buildings where they actually are using portable units right now. So they have a bond issue up at the same time that'll be on the ballot on April 2nd that's mm-hmm. important to get passed. It's a no tax increase bond issue. So I've got a lot of experience with more than anybody else working with the school districts on that, on the real issues. And I'll tell you, the key issues from a school board perspective for our public schools are pre-K is definitely important. Because if a child, we can't close that gap early enough, they'll never catch up later on. You can put all the resources in seventh or eighth grade, it'll be too late. Mm-hmm. So we've got to increase those opportunities. Hunger and mobility are the other two issues mainly that you see a lot of challenges with it. A lot of the school districts have really been innovative and stepped up. Hickman Mills has pre-K for all kids already. Some of the other school districts, KCMO, has some of it. This will fill the gap. So I think everybody's in agreement that pre-K is a good idea. The concern I have is the being a former school board member is when you don't have even one of the school districts stepping up to endorse what's supposed to be benefiting them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, that's where the collaboration and maybe taking a little more time on this might have been a good idea to get everybody on board. I'd feel a lot better about this passing if everybody was on board.
So come April 2nd, how's Scott Taylor going to vote on this?
I'll tell you, personally, I personally can afford the increase, so I will support it personally. Mm-hmm. I just am really concerned, and my hope is if it passes, those that will be responsible for administering the fund would sit down with the school districts again and try to work something out before we actually roll anything out, because I think it's important to have the school districts involved with what they're responsible for.
The other complaint you hear is that it's 0.75 cents for a boost in the sales tax. That's a big bite of the apple, maybe too much for folks who are on lower incomes. The tax, sales tax, is widely seen as regressive, Scott.
Yeah, I agree. On going door to door now to over 30,000 households in the city, I can tell you one of the issues. I think there's a with these sales taxes on the ballot, kind of a fatigue setting in. We've done some really good work to get our infrastructure set up for the next 20 years, and everybody was on board with it because they understood. We've done other the PIAC renewal. I think everybody understands the importance of neighborhoods mm-hmm. of that. I think we need to, other than extending what's already in place as far as public safety and police and fire, those are important, and e-tax is important. I think we need to take a pause on some of these new initiatives, and that's why on the affordable housing thing that's on the ballot, I have a concern the way that's being financed as well.
Yeah, give me just 1 minute on climate change. What's the role of city government when it comes to dealing with climate change right now? You know, Washington not doing a whole lot. What is Kansas City's responsibility?
It's a big responsibility. Cities need to step up on this. We have in Kansas City. You know, in the last term, I led the Energy Empowerment Ordinance. We got largest building owners to start benchmarking their energy so that they could go in and make changes to reduce emissions. We got a lot of pushback from the industry on it, but we fought through it, got it done. I've got in front of the council right now a resolution that will turn us to 100% renewable, and the date will probably change from what's in there. But look at solar, identify city property for solar panels, and make those available, that energy, to city employees first and others in the community. So we need to keep moving forward, and hopefully the next council mayor will take that leadership up, because we've got a tradition in Kansas City. And the great thing is, once we lead, other cities follow.
Yeah. That's City Councilman Scott Taylor. He's a candidate for mayor of Kansas City. Scott, thanks for coming in and sharing your views. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about that measles outbreak in Washington State and what it means for this part of the country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we learned how screen time can impact your child's test scores and what changes it causes in their brains. Hear that and other previous conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, it's the number one killer of men and women, but it's a preventable disease, and February is Heart Month, so we'll talk about the steps you can take to stay heart healthy. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this wasn't supposed to happen anymore, but here we are again talking about a measles outbreak 19 years after measles were declared eliminated from the United States following large-scale vaccination campaigns. One big reason it's happening again, some parents avoid getting themselves or their kids vaccinated. With us here to talk about this, Dr. Carol Carrilla is an assistant professor of internal medicine with the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. And Dr. Carrilla, so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, how preventable is this measles outbreak in Washington State or anywhere for that matter? What you're thinking there?
It is extremely preventable with vaccination.
So why are we back in this space once again?
I wish I had the answer to that, certain. There's a lot of concern with different vaccines and their toxicity or side effects. I even read that they had fears about a conspiracy, and that just isn't the case.
If you could sit one of those parents down, you would tell them what, doctor?
I would tell them how safe the vaccines are, how for years and years they've been tested and proven. There's a lot of healthy people walking around that have received those same vaccines. And the incredible depth that goes into developing any vaccine, new or old, as well as the potential side effects. Anything has a side effect of sorts. But it is so minor considering what the consequences are of the disease itself.
Yeah. Well, let me take this opportunity to invite some parents, maybe those parents, to call in with their questions about vaccinations. We have a terrific expert here in the house. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Carol, what are the dangers, you know, of having people in the population who have not been vaccinated?
The person that's not vaccinated can carry the disease even if they aren't having symptoms. And all of the diseases that the vaccines have been developed for are highly, highly contagious. And so we can spread a disease even just by talking, like in this room. It doesn't have to be coughing or sneezing that spreads the droplets that spread the disease.
It's that contagious.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. How can someone carry the disease and not have it manifest itself?
Usually there's a window where they have contracted the disease, but the symptoms don't show up. Different processes, different diseases have different windows of time. Some it's a couple of days to a couple of weeks.
It's kind of a weird idea.
Yes, it is.
You're a ticking time bomb walking around out there.
Correct.
You know, USA Today just carried a column with this headline, Doctor, "Today's skepticism of vaccines could be as big of a health threat as HIV." Does that sound right to you?
I think so.
Because?
Because HIV is not spread simply by being in the same room with someone whereas these other diseases that we're talking about are spread so easily, even, like I said, by talking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you can get some of the illnesses, particularly flu, by even touching a doorknob that someone else has touched. So they are so easily spread, much more so than even the HIV, because it implies some sort of contact with bodily fluids.
Now, I'm just wondering, you know, for a doctor like you, given the fact these vaccinations are out there and so widely available, there has to be some built-in frustration when it comes to this issue for someone like yourself.
Very much so.
That here we are talking about measles outbreaks in 2019.
Yes. Yeah. I would absolutely confirm that.
Yeah. Our phone number again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some phone calls here and go to Kristen from Independence. Kristen, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. Great to talk to you guys. My question is, do you know anything about public policies as far as keeping my child from being regularly exposed to children whose parents have elected not to vaccinate, like school policies about vaccinations and that kind of thing?
Oh, that's interesting. How do schools handle something like that, Carol?
I don't know the specifics for particular school districts, and different states have different rules as far as allowing children to even go to school without vaccinations. But I think the concern is part of what we're talking about, that the parents who do try to keep their children safe through vaccination still have contact with people that are quite ill,
mm-hmm.
and may not even realize it yet because they're a carrier first.
So if you have the vaccination, could you still contract the disease?
Typically not, but you may contract a really mild version.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the different illnesses.
Yeah.
But it's much less severe. I mean, it's negligible.
Kristen, what do you think the policy should be out there?
I think that if a parent chooses not to vaccinate for whatever reason, which I thoroughly disagree with, then they ought to, accompanying that choice, they ought to choose to homeschool because I don't know, and maybe the doctor can help me with this too, as far as I've heard the phrase herd immunity, but I do know that it is possible for, even though mild, for a child who is vaccinated to get sick. And I just feel like if a parent makes that decision, they shouldn't make it for the rest of us. You know what I mean?
Hmm. What about that idea that a child should be homeschooled, doctor, if a parent chooses not to vaccinate the child for whatever range of diseases we're talking about here?
I think that's one consideration. However, most typically, even with the homeschooled, they will still be out in church groups, in other social settings where they will still be able to inoculate someone.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So keeping them at home doesn't keep them out of harm's way in the long run, nor does it keep them from sharing a disease once they contact it.
So are you saying there really is no answer then, given the way people are? People get out and mingle with other people?
I think that's correct.
Yeah. Kristen, I hope that helps.
It's kind of scary for parents of young children, but it is,
absolutely.
It is kind of the way it is. But I've just made sure to keep my kids' vaccinations up to date, and that's all I can do to protect them and care for them if they get sick, I guess.
Well, do you know what percentage of the kids in your child's classes, Kristen, are not immunized?
I don't, but I, as far as conversations I've had with parents and the sort of overtone of the people that I see around my kids, it's generally been fairly across the board vaccinate. There's, you know, there's always small risks, but it has been, you know, anyone who does any kind of intelligent research can see that it's been so rigorously tested that,
right.
You know, most all parents I speak with tend to agree with that. And the couple that I've spoken with that don't, we just don't do play dates with them.
Right, right. Kristen, thank you for the call.
That's totally sad for the kids, but it's the only way that I can think to protect my children.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Kristen. I appreciate it. Let's go to Chelsea from Olathe. Chelsea, you're on Up to Date. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Go ahead, Chelsea.
Hi, thank you so much. This topic is so interesting to me. I'm a pediatric nurse, and I feel very strongly about vaccinating and do vaccinate my children, but I have a lot of compassion for just the fear that parents deal with in making decisions for their children and a lot of the misunderstanding that there is about vaccines. And there's a comment that a pediatrician I worked with a number of years ago made to me that has really stuck with me that I wondered if you could respond to. You know, one of the big things, and I think the caller was just talking about it, you know, people being afraid, for instance, about autism and that being a cause of specifically the MMR vaccine. And there's just no research to support that. But the pediatrician told me that there's a lot we don't understand about autism, and it could be that one of the triggers could be a virus. And because vaccines do create an immune system response, could that be? And he was just speculating, you know, could that be part of it? And there's just, that has stuck with me. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Doctor?
I would say that as far as my experience and information, that's very low likelihood. Excuse me. We don't know a lot about so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that over the years, there is still a lot to learn about autism and any other of the concerned side effects or end effects from the vaccinations, not to mention anything else in life. But I think that, again, time has tested. The first vaccine was developed in 1796 by Edward Jenner.
Wow.
That's a very long time ago, and it was smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
And that has enabled the world to be declared free of smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
And these are vicious diseases. We think of them as childhood rashes and a fever and, you know, maybe some nausea and vomiting, but they have horrible consequences.
How about measles? What kind of consequences does that have?
They can develop encephalitis, which is infection in the brain, and they can have permanent brain damage from it. Excuse me. They can also have hearing or vision that is permanently impaired, if not totally damaged. And that's just a short list of what I know can happen.
So your argument is that the dangers of contracting measles far outweigh any danger, small danger that might be associated with the vaccination itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Greg from Lawrence. Greg, you're on Up to Date.
Hello. I understand that the physician may not want to answer a policy type question. My question is pretty simple. Is there never any discussion of making it a crime not to vaccinate? I say that in the context of having personal experience about a child who has permanent hearing loss because parents failed to vaccinate. And I'm sure you know hundreds of examples of that.
Yes.
Aside from the contagion issue, they're basically abusing their child. So that's my question. Is there never discussion of that being becoming a criminal act?
Why not make it a law, doctor?
I think that in the country where we value our freedom so strongly, that's a difficult, slippery slope that people talk about. Someone mentioned that we require child seats for our children. That's a law. Maybe it ought to be extended, but I think that there's definitely discussion. I can answer that part, that as far as public policy and lawmaking, there definitely is a discussion about should it be allowed, should it be legal or not. I think that debate is ongoing.
You wouldn't oppose that idea? Am I hearing you right?
I would consider it perhaps a viable option.
Yeah. Okay. Back to some calls. Phyllis from Bonner Springs. Phyllis, you're on Up to Date.
Well, I just had a comment to share. When I was young and my brothers were young, we were all vaccinated. I never had any of the childhood diseases, and yet the doctor said I was the carrier, and I brought them home to my brothers.
Can a doctor know that, Dr. Carrillo?
No.
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of.
So maybe you can absolve Phyllis of any guilt she's been carrying all these years? Is that what we're talking about here?
Did the doctor do blood levels to verify that you're carrying the illness?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm 68 years old, and this was back when I was much, much younger. I really don't know. I just know that that's what I was always told from our childhood. My childhood pediatrician in turn became an allergist, Dr. Spear.
Ah.
And that's just what he always said. that I was the carrier.
Well, then your brother should thank you.
Yeah.
I think so, too.
Thank them because?
They got secondary immunity from her contact.
Okay.
Right. Well, I know when I got pregnant the first time, my doctors were very, very concerned because I had not had the measles. And so I had to be very careful where I went and who I was around.
All right.
In case I did get them now in my life. So I just wanted to see what she had to say about that.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Carrillo, what goes into creating a vaccine? Just a quick overview. How does that happen?
Most of the viruses or inoculants that the diseases themselves have all of them have proteins in their cell membrane that's on the outside of that cell membrane or particle membrane. Sometimes they aren't a complete cell. And with that, amazing science can be done, and they can glean that protein and isolate it out and then develop a base to deliver it and develop immunity. Oftentimes, the viruses that you receive in your shots are not even still alive. Mm-hmm. Most of them are not.
Yeah.
But they can still stimulate the immune response with that coating of that protein.
You know, yes or no, can a person die from a reaction to a vaccine?
That's not a yes or no answer.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Simply because as far as the reaction to the vaccine, no, they don't die. But if you have an allergy to something, and the most typical thing we think about is eggs with flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
If they have a deathly serious reaction to eggs, then if it's – and not all vaccines are developed with an egg addition. So it depends on what base you're having and what brand it is and so forth.
Well, what percentage of those vaccinated have a reaction, and what are the range of symptoms that develop out of something like this?
I don't know the exact percentage of how many have a reaction, but the reactions most commonly are soreness at the site of injection. It's a sharp object. You put it in somebody, they're going to have a little soreness in the muscle where they got it.
And that's about it in terms of reaction.
They can develop a mild fever. They can also develop generalized body aches. But often what we'll say is that demonstrates that your immune response is good because you're showing signs of it being revved up.
I was going to say, can a person contract the disease because they just got vaccinated?
No.
Okay. Because it's just too small of a dose?
Correct.
Yeah. How many various types of vaccinations are available these days?
16.
16. Against a range of diseases like what? What are you talking about?
Measles, mumps, and rubella are the MMR that go together in one shot. Diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis are also included in one shot.
What's pertussis?
Pertussis is whooping cough. And if you have ever heard a child that has whooping cough, it breaks my heart to think about watching a child go through that.
Okay. Back to some calls. Jody from Kansas City, Missouri. Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, Steve. Interesting topic. So I have teenagers. 20 years ago, when a friend of mine handed me a book she'd read on why not to vaccinate, she told me she had decided to vaccinate, and it came down to her at the end of the day. If she tried to prevent something bad from happening and there was an adverse effect, could she live with that more than not doing anything to protect her kid and something bad happen? And so for me, I'm a learned person. I was a doula, did home births and the natural stuff, but also vaccinated my kids because at the end of the day, as a mom or dad, as a parent, we ask ourselves, is it better to do the right thing and try, or is the right thing to not do anything? Either way, you're going to take the consequences. And I'm putting that out there for moms and dads who read all the science and still are in this quandary.
Okay. Jody, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Ben from Leawood. Ben, you're on the air.
State of California requires that all children who go to public school and private schools must be in there. If not, they can't go, period. We should do the same here, period.
You've got to be vaccinated, you're saying, in California, Ben.
Yes.
Okay.
It should be the same everywhere.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Michael from Edgerton on the Missouri side. Michael, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Thanks. Good subject. I'm a nurse, and my thought is to you guys is what I see as a nurse with all vaccinations, all ages of my patients, is education. And there's just this real big lack of trust of to me, medicine, medical system, you know, pay source, you know, and stuff. And it's just really an educational issue. And how do you regain that trust of a patient, a person that you're wanting to do something for and to? That's kind of where I see it. And as a parent, I got two boys, you know, and I've met lots of people that are the non-vaccinating type, you know,
right.
And I understand their arguments and stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think we got to start, you know, education early in parents. Pre-parent, you know.
Right. Well, Mike, let me get a comment from a doctor. Lack of faith in our institutions goes well beyond the medical field, I think.
Absolutely. And I think that's just a common thread for a lot of issues and policies. But I think, honestly, it came to mind that the primary care setting and the practitioner with the parent one-on-one or one-on-both, you know, if both parents are present, that's the kind of situation that probably has the most fruitful educational setting, where there's hopefully a trust already established with the individuals.
Okay, that's Dr. Carol Carrillo. She's an assistant professor of internal medicine at the Kansas City University of Medicine and Biosciences. Carol, you're great. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Tomorrow on the show, we're joined again by a local minimum wage worker who testified last week before Congress about a possible federal minimum wage. We'll ask him about that experience. You can find us and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.